See, empathy is vulnerable. If I care about you, and if you're suffering, then that'll hurt me, that'll bother me. Now, if you're so badly hurt that you completely shut down your sense of vulnerability, then you're gonna have no empathy. So the lack of empathy is always a sign of trauma, as far as I'm concerned. When you identify as a victim, and purely as a victim, in fact, you even glorify your victimhood, to that degree, you're gonna have less empathy or no empathy.
That's Gabor Mate, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Gabor Mate on history, trauma, and the lack of empathy. History, the past, as Faulkner once wrote, is never dead. It's not even past. Trauma, a Greek word for wound, takes on myriad shapes and forms. It often remains and reverberates through generations. There's individual trauma and collective trauma. However, just because you suffered does not give you permission to inflict suffering on others. Angela Davis said, quote, "Victimization cannot be permitted to function as a halo of innocence," unquote. Empathy is the ability to take on another person's perspective, to understand, feel, and possibly share and respond to their experience. Victims need our empathy, our compassion, but not according to the world's richest man. Elon Musk has said, "The fundamental weakness of Western civilization is empathy." Wow. Our guest today is Gabor Mate. He's a Hungarian-born Canadian physician with a special interest in childhood development, trauma, and potential lifelong impacts on physical and mental health, including addictions. He's the author of the award-winning In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts. He spoke in Melbourne, Australia in mid-February at an event organized by the Jewish Council of Australia and moderated by Emeritus Professor Andrea Durbach.
So I want to start by asking you, how did the events that marked your first year of life shape your development intellectually and emotionally, and importantly, professionally, as a physician with a specific expertise in addiction and trauma?
So my grandfather was actually a Zionist leader, a very prominent one. He was a friend of Vladimir Jabotinsky, who was the founder of the revisionist wing of Zionism, and of which Menachem Begin and Yitzhak Shamir, and most recently and bizarrely, Benjamin Netanyahu were the representatives. He was killed in Auschwitz when I was 5 months of age. And what saved my mother and I was really only the fact that we lived in Budapest. And as the Germans who moved into Hungary in March 1944, as they emptied the country of Jews, they did it concentrically. And Budapest was in the center. And by that time, the world actually told the Hungarian government to stop. So they did. And that's what saved our lives. Not that terrible things didn't happen afterwards. How did it affect me? Well, first of all, there's a story I've told many times before. The Germans occupied Budapest in March of 44. I was 2 months of age. Next day, the pediatrician whom my mother calls to come and see me, because I'm crying all the time, says to my mom, "Of course I'll come, but I should tell you, all my Jewish babies are crying." Now, of course, what does that speak to? It speaks to the fact that infants soak up the unconscious and the tensions of the parent. So when the mother is in pain, the baby's in pain. And that's how we spent my first year. My father was in forced labor. For the most part, my mother didn't know if he was dead or alive. Then her sister and her parents were deported to Auschwitz. In the fall of 1944, an even more vicious anti-Semitic fascist party took control in Hungary. That's when they began second wave of killing of Jews. Another 100,000 people were killed. There's a monument by the Danube, if you visit Budapest now, of Jewish shoes, metal shoes, sculpture. And because representing the Jews that were marched onto the Danube by this fascist militia and shot into the river. So that's the shadow under which I spent the first year of my life. When I was 11 months of age, my mother gave me to a stranger to save my life, and a Christian woman, completely unknown, who conveyed me to some relatives in relatively relative. So I lived with them for 6 weeks, didn't see my mother for all that time. What did this do to my psyche? It's interesting. Sometimes when people watch my stuff on YouTube, and I'm joking, and I'm thought I'm being very, you know, personable, somebody says, "He looks so depressed." And they're picking up on something. No, they're projecting. That's all they see, and that's not all there is. But they're picking up on something. Because in photograph of me as an infant, as a child, there's this faraway look of sadness, and it's still here sometimes. So there's that. Some years ago, I took part in a ketamine psychedelic training, and I was amongst, I'll tell you two psychedelic stories. One is, I'm lying there injected with the ketamine, along with 10 or 11 others, and we each have a minder and, you know, it's a safe setting. And people under the influence of this psychedelic are having divine visitations and angelic appearances and universal love and unity. And me, I start screaming, "I hate the world." That's my fun, you know, so that's my baseline. I don't identify with it, but that's my baby. Of course, who wouldn't? That's the feeling of the child in that situation. The world is a hateful place. The other psychedelic experience I can tell you is 7 or 8 years ago, I took some mushrooms therapeutically along with a therapist. I'm perfectly aware that I'm this author and writer and father and physician, and 73, 74 years of age. I know this is a psychedelic session. I know that I've taken a mushroom. I know this woman is a therapist, but at the same time, I'm experiencing myself as a one-year-old baby, and she's my mother. So I have this double consciousness, and I start crying, and I say, "I'm so sorry I made your life so difficult." And that's the self-belief of a child whose parents are suffering. Children take it on, they think it's their fault. Which then can lead to a tremendous drive to make it better and to fix Mother Earth and to fix the world. So what can I say? That experience gave me a deep sense of injustice and how terrible things happen to people for no fault of their own. And both a calling, which is a good thing, and a drivenness, which is not a good thing, to try and fix the world. Those are the main influences, the main impacts, I would say.
So the precarious experience of being a Jew that you described in Eastern Europe in 1944, I've heard you say compelled you or called you, certainly in your teenage years in Canada, towards Zionism.
Yeah.
Because in your words, and I'm quoting you, it appeared to be the perfect answer to that horrific history. It was like a redemption, a regaining of power, a proud assertion of a proud Jewish identity. And really an antidote to hundreds of years of persecution. But Gabor, then in subsequent years, you've spoken very critically of Zionism and its essence and rejected its tenets, and particularly its contemporary manifestation. stating that it's had horrific consequences, and I quote you again, for the Palestinian people, and lamentable consequences for the Jewish people, that it has a corrupting influence on the Jewish soul.
Yeah.
What triggered this revision?
It wasn't any overnight epiphany, it was gradual. I was a Zionist youth leader. I was the head of a Zionist youth group in Vancouver. And as you say, I was impelled towards Zionism as it makes sense. We were persecuted, wandering everywhere. We had this ancient homeland from which we were expelled. And ever since then, we've been persecuted. It's time to go back, reestablish ourselves, and claim our right to be a people, have our own army, our own state, where we no longer a despised and vulnerable minority. That makes perfect sense. And for the psychological wound of, that's one part of it. There's a psychological part as well, which is that the American black psychologist, Dr. Kenneth Hardy, talks about what he calls the assaulted sense of self. And that's that the abused individual or collective takes on a view of themselves that the perpetrator has. So abused children tend to despise themselves. As somebody said, when parents abuse the child will love the parents and hate himself. Now, this is also true in the collective sense. So American blacks, for example, used to hate being black. They used to hate the fact that their hair was curly. Malcolm X, the black leader, describes in his autobiography putting this searing chemical on his scalp to try and straighten his hair. And people tried to bleach their skin. And Malcolm X once said to people, "Who taught you to hate the shape of your lips or the shape of your nose or the color of your skin?" And you see this everywhere. Everywhere there's colonialism. White is good, and the darker you are, the lower status you are. This is true in India. This is true in Africa. It's true in South America. It's also true for Jews. A lot of Jews develop a negative sense of themselves for the same reasons. And I had that. So Zionism, which all of a sudden gave me a sense of pride and identification and even a sense of superiority, the sense of belonging to this proud ancient race, was also an antidote to the, not just to the historical dilemma of the Jewish people, as I understood it, but also to the psychological dilemma. There's only a few things wrong with that perspective. One is, this may be surprising to you, but there was never any expulsion from Palestine. Didn't happen. It's a story. It's a story. Most Jews never came from Palestine. They were converts elsewhere. Already in ancient times, at the time of the destruction of the Second Temple in 70 AD, many more Jews were living outside Palestine than inside Palestine. In the 5th century, there were Arab Jewish kingdoms in Arabia, kingdoms of Jews. There were large numbers of Jewish converts in India, in China, in North Africa. So the story of this wandering people, and by the way, you know what? The Egyptian exile never happened. No historical evidence whatsoever. In fact, at the time that the Jews were supposed to have left Egypt, Palestine was a part of Egypt. And there's no evidence of any migration, none of that. There's no great kingdoms of David and Solomon story. Maybe there was a king called David, a small tribal enclave. So this whole story that we've addicted to is itself a mythology. Well, I didn't find that out right away, but the first thing that happened was when I was still a Zionist, and by the way, I'm talking about stuff that's been uncovered by Israeli Jewish historians. But let me tell you something really interesting. David Ben-Gurion and Yitzhak Ben-Tzvi, Ben-Gurion became the first prime minister of Israel. He was the head of the Mapai, the Labor Party, the progressive wing, so-called, of the Zionist movement. Yitzhak Ben-Tzvi became the second president of Israel after the death of the first one, Chaim Weizmann. They wrote a book together in 1922 based on their research, in which they argued that given that the Jews were not expelled from Palestine, what happened to them? Well, the ones that stayed there were the peasants, the people that worked the land. Guess what? When the Muslims came in, they converted to Islam, which means that many of the, not all, but many of the Palestinians may actually be the descendants of ancient Jews. Ben-Gurion and Yitzhak Ben-Tzvi argued this. They're not the only ones. When I was still in the Zionist movement, I was given the task of how do we combat, I'm talking the 1960s now, how do we combat Arab propaganda on the campuses? Nothing new under the sun, right? So I thought, well, maybe if I'm going to talk about how to combat it, maybe I should find out what it is. So I started looking at what the Palestinians were saying. And I remember one event where I was given the job of representing the Palestinian point of view. Not that I believed in it, but once I look into something, I know how to represent it. So I gave the Palestinian argument. People were outraged with me. How can you say these things? I said, look, I'm just doing my job. Then what happened was that the Vietnam War happened. And during the Vietnam War, the Western press mercilessly lied. They denied the carnage, the mass murders, the bombings, the conspiracy of deceit on which the Vietnam War was based, in the name of which 2 or 3 million people were massacred. Then the 1967 crisis came up in the Middle East, and actually I volunteered to go to Israel then, you know, to serve as a, to replace soldiers who had to go to battle. I didn't end up going because the war happened so quickly, but I still had my Zionist faith up to a point, but I began to question, why is the same press that so enthusiastically and relentlessly lying about Vietnam, so supportive of Israel? The same dishonest, malevolent Western press. And then I began to do some research, and by the fall of 67, I wrote an article for the student newspaper which said that actually Israel concocted and deliberately provoked this war in order to capture more territory that they'll never give back. Well, that article made me persona non grata in the Jewish community and got me kicked out of my parents' home. But by that time, I knew. And that's when I began to do the research, and I found out that right from the beginning of Zionism, there had been Jews, even Zionists, who opposed the Zionist project because they knew where it was going, and that the slogan of a land without a people, for a people without a land, was a lie. There was no land without a people. In 1917, when the anti-Semite Arthur Balfour issued the Balfour Declaration, saying that, you know, Her Majesty's government views with favor the establishment of a Jewish, who the hell is Her Majesty's government to view with favor anything? But when he said that, there were roughly 500,000 to 600,000 Palestinians and maybe 50,000 to 75,000 Jews in Palestine. So that what became clear to anybody with open eyes, and people did have their eyes open, is that this project could never be accomplished without suppressing the Palestinian people. And Ben-Gurion and Jabotinsky both said that. They said very clearly, they said, we call the Arab terrorists, but they're not terrorists, they're just defending their homeland. Any people would defend their homeland. We're threatening to take away their homeland. Of course they're fighting back. They said that privately. Publicly, the Arabs are terrorists, you know. So, boy, I could go on forever, but in a nutshell, I found out the actual history. The actual history that by now has been documented by Jewish Israeli historians like Ilan Pappe, like Benny Morris, who is a lunatic, but he did document the expulsion of the Palestinians, the massacres by the Jewish militia, the rapes of Palestinian women, the bulldozing destruction of homes, 500 Palestinian villages were destroyed, the whole lie about the Arabs telling the Palestinians to leave, that didn't happen. Didn't happen. The Arab invasion, totally a false and distorted narrative. The terrorism and the destruction of Palestinian villages started half a year before the Arab invasion. And one could go on forever. And it's continued since. There's no epiphany, but I learned the history. And I learned the history not as documented by Palestinians, but as documented by Jews and Israelis. So that's all there is to it. Nobody who knows the history can possibly believe a word of the Zionist propaganda talking points. It's all ludicrous nonsense.
Gabor, I've been so struck about how powerful Zionism can be in altering the vision of Jews in their stance on Palestine, who would otherwise take quite a progressive stance on related injustices in the world. And so perhaps naively, I've always believed that Jews following the unimaginable cruelty and scale of the Holocaust would perhaps see the parallels with the sustained Israeli occupation and the systemic dehumanization that you've just spoken to and the decimation of Palestinians. So I want to ask you, what happens to allow this collective compartmentalization, some would say hypocrisy, or disassociation? How do people get to this kind of selective application of human values that Jews believe are so intrinsic to Jewish tenets and ideals?
Yeah. I don't think it's hypocrisy. I actually think they don't know. Hypocrisy is if I know something and I pretend otherwise. I don't think they know. They don't permit themselves to know. So in the yogic, not that I know much about yogic philosophy, but from what I understand, in the yogic understanding of the mind, there are these four dynamics. There's the intellect, which can discern. There's awareness, which is consciousness, which holds everything. There's memory, conscious and unconscious, which is like a store of everything you've experienced and heard and downloaded. And then there's identity. And identity is what you identify with, what you consider yourself the same as. And identity governs everything in the unconscious. So if you identify with this traumatized history of this nation expelled from its homeland and always suffering, in which there's a lot of truth, of course. And if that's how you identify, then your intellect will not permit for you to, it will not absorb any facts that go contrary. And Zionism pretty much has become a cult. It's become a cult. You can talk about in the abstract about Zionism representing the self-determination of the Jewish people, but I mean, that's nonsense. I mean, if Zionism represents the self-determination of the Jewish people, why aren't the Jews flocking to Israel? But they never have. Even after the Second World War, most of those refugees did not want to go to Palestine. The Zionists worked very hard to force people to go to Palestine. It's like, for me, Zionism is an antidote to that sense of powerlessness and sense of the persecuted identity. And if you identify with that, it's that identification on the unconscious level that makes people completely impermeable, makes them totally impermeable. So they could be progressive on civil rights in the States, apartheid in South Africa, and impermeable when it comes to the experience of the Palestinians, because they'd have to give up their identification. Also, of course, there's a powerful community. Let me actually read you something. So Thomas Merton was a Catholic monk and a mystic in the 50s. He wrote a wonderful biography, autobiography called Seven Story Mountain. He's saying that people keep trying to escape. Like the life in this individualistic, aggressive, alienated, materialistic society is very alienating for people. The self that people have is very fragile. So they need something to identify with, which makes them stronger. And Merton says there are many escapes from the external self, this alienated self. For example, the experience of being seized and taken out of oneself by collective enthusiasm in a totalitarian parade, the self-righteous upsurge of loyalty that blots out conscience and absorbs every criminal tendency in the name of nation, party, race, or sect. And he says that this people are escaping from their true selves and putting their conscience to sleep and turning free, reasonable human beings into passive instruments of the power politician. And Zionism is, in that sense, just like fascism or other political ideologies. It gives you a sense of identity, a sense of meaning, a large community to belong to, who validates you and reinforces your self-belief. And if you look at these crazy settlers dancing in utter ecstasy over the graves of Palestine, they're cultists. And Zionism, by and large, has become a cult. It functions like one. It also functions like one, as many of you may have found out, when you leave it, you're excommunicated. So, I mean, any of you who've spoken up publicly have been called choice names. Self-hating Jews, capos, terrorist supporters. It's not that they disagree with you. They can't even contemplate yet that you're coming from a sincere place. You have to be demonized. That's what a cult does. When you leave a cult, you get ostracized and attacked. So it's, well, to summarize, it's a deep sense of identification with a certain view of oneself, which Zionism acts as an antidote and an escape from. And it provides you with a very powerful group identification, which is moreover reinforced by the colonial countries in which most Jews live. Like Australia is a colonial country.
You're listening to Gabor Mate on history, trauma, and the lack of empathy. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977 or online our website, alternativeradio.org.
Australia is a colonial country. The massacres of native people, well, that's Australian history. Now, if Australia was going to openly admit that and deal with it, then they might consider the situation of Palestinians. But in Canada, 5 years ago, there was a poll about residential schools. Now, residential schools in Canada were where Indigenous kids were abducted from their homes, forbidden to see their parents, and under the aegis of the church or the state, were abused sexually, physically, emotionally, beaten. Many of them died, many got sick. All were traumatized. And this is not even vaguely controversial. And 4 years ago, 5 years ago, there was a poll in Canada. 70% of people did not know or knew little about those residential schools. Now, it's illegal in Canada to deny the Holocaust. It's not illegal to deny the massacre of Native people. So what I'm saying is that the Zionist self-image is reinforced by the colonial context. And all the countries that were responsible for genocides all around the world, Belgium, you know, how many of you knew that the Belgians killed 12 million Congolese at the end of the 19th, beginning of the 20th century? Raise your hand if you knew that little fact. 12 million. Three of you know about it. Not your fault. They don't teach it in this country because it was a colonial enterprise. Did you know that the first German genocide was not against the Jews? Do you know where it was? In Namibia. In the 20th century, earlier 20th century. I could go on, but what I'm saying is that the Zionist narrative and perspective is held and supported by these countries, so that to be a Zionist is to be very respectable in Canada. The Canadian Prime Minister says, I'm a Zionist. We have the same values as Israel. Yes, we do. The replacement and dispossession and oppression and ongoing exploitation of the indigenous people. So it's not just Jews and Zionism, it's also the broader world imperial context. See, empathy is vulnerable. If I care about you and if you're suffering, then that'll hurt me, that'll bother me. Now, if you're so badly hurt that you completely shut down your sense of vulnerability, then you can have no empathy. So the lack of empathy is always a sign of trauma, as far as I'm concerned. When you identify as a victim, and purely as a victim, in fact, you even glorify your victimhood, to that degree, you're gonna have less empathy or no empathy for the other. Now, let's look at the Jewish rituals and traditions. You have Passover, which is, again, it never happened. But the story is that our God was so good to us that he massacred the firstborn, the innocent firstborn of Egypt. Oh yeah, we drop a few drops of wine because in recognizing the suffering. But basically, this is what our God did for us. In the Old Testament, what the Christians call it, the Old Testament, in the Tanakh, the Jewish Bible, God threatens to destroy the Jews because they didn't follow his command to kill all the inhabitants of Palestine, men, women, and children. In the holiday of Purim, which, by the way, again, shows you the story of exile, what nonsense it is, because there are many Jews living in Persia, where the story takes place. They end up killing, the Jews end up killing 75,000 Persians, and this is celebrated. So there's a tremendous tradition. And in the Jewish tradition, there's also the prophetic tradition, to give it its right. There's also this tradition of justice, of the two speakers who say that there's some higher truth than ruler or nation or wealth, and that higher truth is justice for all. So that is in the Jewish tradition as well. So there's this double tradition of deep chauvinism, lack of empathy for the other, the goyim. And if you look at some of the parts of the Talmud, it's horrendous. that on a Shabbat, it's not, if a Jew is in trouble, you can help him or save his life, but a goy, no, you can't. So this is part of our today. We got to own this, a lack of empathy. So lack of empathy is always, to me, a sign of deep hurt on the individual level. On the political level, it's simply the expression of greed and power hunger. So when you have people who have both greed and power hunger and political power and personal hurt, you get monsters of history, like a whole number of people we could mention. In terms of the reshaping of memory, Israel didn't always celebrate the Holocaust. When I say celebrate, I mean venerate it. You know what? The Zionists were contemptuous of the Jews of Eastern Europe. Weaklings. They talked about them like going to slaughter like sheep. It was only in the 70s and 80s that they began to use the Holocaust as a justification. So they used memory quite consciously and quite deliberately and quite manipulatively. Now, if you buy that story that we've always been persecuted and in every generation the nations will rise against us, if that's your belief. Furthermore, if you've been told all your life that the Palestinians are just vicious terrorists, just itching to get at you, to slit your throat, then October the 7th is just another example. Equating this vicious but desperate act of Palestinian resistance with the Nazi genocide, it just seems natural. Oh yeah, it's just one more example, and it makes sense, and you believe it. And this despite the fact, and I'll finish here, that there have been, I can name you at least six Israeli historians, Jewish historians, of genocide. Not just general history, but historians of genocide, whose career and studies have been based on studying genocide for decades, who've said that what's happening in Gaza is genocide. Have you heard that in Australia, in the media, that Jewish Israeli historians who study genocide, who understand genocide like nobody understands genocide, have called Gaza genocide? So there's a real necessity to revamp our memory. But again, we have to let go of the identification as the eternal victim.
As anti-Semitism, as we all know, has accelerated very worryingly in the last 15 months in this country and globally. We continue, as you mentioned earlier, to face the relentless accusations from members of the Jewish community that our criticism of Israel and the systematic extermination of Palestinian people is or feeds anti-Semitism.
Yeah.
And to make things even worse and more complicated, the self-described anti-Semitism watchdog, the Anti-Defamation League, recently dismissed Elon Musk's infamous raised arm at a Trump inauguration rally as an awkward gesture in a moment of enthusiasm. So with all these distortions around anti-Semitism knocking against one another, in my view, anti-Semitism in its intended form seems to be the biggest casualty. And so amidst all this worrying clamor, I want to ask you, how do we create a space for an authentic, meaningful discussion about and in response to hatred against Jews?
I'm reminded of an anti-Semitic mayor of Vienna who, at the turn of the 19th, 20th century, who said the anti-Semite is the person who hates the Jew more than necessary. I come from Eastern Europe. I grew up with anti-Semitism. When I was in the bathroom as a kid at the urinal, and two kids would piss and their streams would cross, make the cross, They say a Jew just died. This is what I grew up with. I know anti-Semitism. I know how to recognize it. I can smell it. It's a very complex question. First of all, studies have shown, this has been not just recently, but before, every time the Israeli army goes into action, anti-Jewish sentiment elevates. That's the first point. Second point is, racism in general is rising in the world. The Jews, if you can speak of the Jews as an entity, which you can't, but if you could, in the Western world, remain amongst the most privileged people in terms of self-expression, access to the arts, academia, job security, wealth, influence, and so on. But at the same time, there is increasing anti-Jewish sentiment, as there is increasing racism. In the States right now, in some states, they teach that slavery was a good thing. And books that teach black history are banned in certain states in the United States. In Europe, there's tremendous anti-Islamic sentiment. Racism in general is rising in the world, and so is anti-Semitism. That's indisputable. But I don't see this distinct from other forms of racism. Number one, we have to ask, why is racism rising, and what are the forces driving that? Number two, when Israel says, and when its stenographers and parrots in the Jewish communities around the world repeat that Israel is the Jewish state, the state of the Jews, when Israel declares itself to be, which it has, the state of the Jews, which means it's not the state of its citizens. It's the state of anybody who's Jewish here, that's your state. If you're a Palestinian in Palestine, it's not your state. If you're an Arab in 67 Israel, it's not your state. It's the state of the Jews. And it's acts in the name of the Jews for the benefit of the Jews. Well, if that's what we're telling the world, then what are people supposed to think of the Jews when the Jews massacre Palestinian children? So who's creating it? Who's creating this identification of mass murder with Jewishness? And people get confused. They believe Netanyahu, and then they become anti-Jewish, if they believe Netanyahu. So that's the main point, is what's creating all this. The same Jewish organizations that complain about anti-Semitism are feeding it with the identification of these unspeakable acts and this oppression and this terrible occupation with the Jews in quotation marks. The last point that I'll make is that the vast majority of people who are opposed to Israeli policy, to Israeli occupation, to the deprivation, they're not anti-Semites. They're just human beings whose hearts are broken. And were Israel to behave differently, they would have no anti-Jewish sentiment whatsoever. So, yeah, there's a minority of racists who will use... Look, you know what an anti-Semite is? I'll tell you a story about an anti-Semite. There was a Roman emperor. There's a story about him. He is being driven on a chariot through the streets of ancient Rome, and a Jew fails to greet him. And the emperor says, "Punish him. How dare he ignore the emperor of Rome?" A few minutes later, another Jew, having heard this, obsequiously bows and salutes the Roman emperor. The emperor says, "Punish him." And his servant say, what for? How dare he draw attention to himself in the presence of the emperor of Rome? Don't you get it? He said, I don't care what a Jew does. I just hate them. Now that's an anti-Semite. There are anti-Semites like that. It doesn't matter. And as Jean-Paul Sartre very famously said about anti-Semite in his book, Anti-Semite and Jew, that the anti-Semite is not afraid of the Jew. He's afraid of himself and his own humanity and his own freedom. So yeah, there is anti-Semitism in the context of a larger recruiting sense of racism. But most of what has to do with Palestine is either a function of the rigid and dogged and vicious identification that the Jewish organizations create with the depredations and crimes of Zionism, and it has to do with people's being appalled. And just to finish, there was this famous case in Germany. There's an Israeli-Palestinian film you may have heard of called No Other Land, made by a Jewish Israeli filmmaker and a Palestinian filmmaker. It's about the takeover and destruction of a Palestinian village in the occupied territories. This film got a prize in Germany. The Jewish director, the Israeli Jewish director, and the Palestinian co-director were on stage receiving the award, and an Israeli said, when we go back, I'll have the right to go anywhere I want. I can vote. I'll have full right of citizenship. My colleague here will be restricted in his movements. He'll have to stop at checkpoints. He's got no right to vote. He's a citizen of he's a non-citizen of an occupied land. In Germany, this was denounced as anti-Semitism. The Jewish director was denounced for being an anti-Semite. The bloody Germans had the gall to tell an Israeli Jew that he's an anti-Semite. And I was in Berlin last year talking about the same subject. Let me tell you, the Germans have not learned a thing. They've simply transferred their contempt from their victim to the victim of their victim. And so when people talk about anti-Semitism, I barely have the patience to even answer them because it's so polluted and it's so twisted and it's so much the function of Israel and the mainstream Jewish organizations.
I want to end now, Gabor, with a final question. Given your lifelong and currently your more intense focus on Palestine and Gaza in particular, what does Gaza now signal or represent for you and the world as we are entering what seems to be an even more, if that's even possible, troubling future for that poor land?
Yeah. Well, Andrea, as you told me when you visited there, I think you said 2009, mm-hmm. You cried every day. Mm-hmm. The first time I visited there during the first Intifada, I cried every day for 2 weeks. This is long before Gaza. It was already so horrendous, so inhumane, so ugly, so evil, so hypocritical. None of us at that time, you in 2009 or me, and indeed I was in Palestine in 2022, I should say, working in the West Bank with Palestinian women who had been tortured in Israeli jails. But even knowing all the history and having seen it with their own eyes, even having seen the repeated Israeli devastations of Gaza bombing campaigns, which elegantly they call mowing the lawn, and even knowing that the Israeli sociologist Burke Kimmerling called Gaza the world's largest concentration camp decades ago. I don't think any of us could have foreseen the extent of what they've done now. This truly is a watershed for human evil and for the fullest expression of the Western colonial mind. And I'm afraid that the short-term outlook is devastating. Israel might very well succeed in the long-held Zionist dream of expelling all the Palestinians. They may succeed. They now have a U.S. administration who the new American ambassador to Israel, Mike Huckabee, doesn't use the word occupation or settlement. He calls them neighborhoods and communities. They don't believe it's occupied. It's Samaria and Judea. And who knows? They might yet succeed. But historically speaking, it'll be one of the watershed moments in human history. People look back to it as the ultimate and clearest expression of the Western colonial mentality and what it's capable of and its inhumanity. And it'll both disturb and inspire people for a long time to seek justice, to seek truth, to speak out. So that's going to happen. And both you and I were struck by the utter humanity of the Palestinian people. How humble they are, how sweet they are, how welcoming they are, how desperate they are. Just tell our stories, just tell our stories, they kept saying to me. See, I don't think we Jews are any different from anybody else. I've always said, when people say, how can Jews do this after what happened to them? You know what my response is? We Jews have just as much right to be mass murderers as everybody else. We're just human beings. This is not just a Jewish issue. It's an issue of the nature of the world that we live in, the forces that govern it, the nature of the system that dominates this world right now. And its most concentrated expression is Gaza right now. So that's what we see from space when you look at Gaza, is what this system, never mind Israel, never mind Jews or Palestinians, what this system is capable of. And if that does not, and that's going to be at some point seen as a real watershed in human history, as Angela Davis said, a real litmus point. I just finally mention, there was a documentary made when I was in Palestine in 2022, not about me, I'm in it very briefly, but when I did that workshop for women traumatized in jails, it's called Where the Olive Trees Weep, and you can find it online. It's a beautiful film. If you want to know about the occupation, watch Where the Olive Trees Weep. I think I've exhausted my answer.
Thank you.
Or the audience, which is really whatever the case may be.
Beautiful. Thank you, Garba Marti.
Thank
so
you.
Much.
Thank you. Thank you.
You were just listening to Gabor Mate on history, trauma, and the lack of empathy. He spoke in Melbourne, Australia in mid-February at an event organized by the Jewish Council of Australia. Gabor Mate is a Hungarian-born Canadian physician and an award-winning author. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, an independent nonprofit in our 39th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Shama Sawant, Tariq Ali, Norman Finkelstein, Ilan Pape, Peter Behnert, and Francesca Albanese. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Gabor Mate on History, Trauma, and the Lack of Empathy, and for Rashid Khalidi's classic book, The 100 Years' War on Palestine, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. To get them, just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to Tim Butler for technical assistance. Joe Rich is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening. We go out with the East Western Divan Orchestra, conducted by Daniel Barenboim, performing Ode to Joy from Beethoven's Ninth Symphony.